You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear how one Milwaukee elementary school is improving attendance numbers by inviting kids to be part of a walking bus. First, new data from the State Department of Justice shows more than 500 DNA matches have been made from a backlog of recently tested sexual assault kits. The backlog was a central theme in this year's race for Wisconsin Attorney General, with more than 4,000 kits that were left untested until this year, despite some being decades old. Keegan Kyles, an investigative reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin. Keegan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You've been following this story for a while. Before we get into this new development, remind us what these kits are and why we had this big backlog of them.
Sure. So after a person reports being sexually assaulted, they'll often go to a hospital to be medically examined. And the evidence that is collected during that exam is packaged up and produced and called a rape kit. And that evidence can then be sent to a crime lab and tested for DNA, which can often be used to in court cases or just to for investigation. But in many cases, over the past decades, these kits were not sent to the state crime labs for testing. They were kept in hospitals or police stations. And now the state is trying to catch up with all of this unprocessed work.
So we've got all these tested kits now. We've talked a lot about how that came about over the last few years. What kind of things are we finding out? What are these DNA matches we're hearing about?
Well, the DNA matches have looked at these kits and checked them against both national offender databases, so people who were previously arrested or convicted for all sorts of crimes, and also evidence collected from crime scenes, what's called forensic databases. And of those two databases, the state rape kits have matched up with 224 cases of cold hits, where it is pointing to people who are not previously named as suspects in sexual assault cases. And these are potential new leads for investigators. There were also 239 warm hits, which is pointing to people who were previously known to detectives or investigators as suspects. So those could be cases of confirmation of someone involved in a sexual assault case. So this is developments in hundreds of cases that now detectives across the state will be looking at to decide whether to reopen cases and maybe reconsider whether to press charges.
So these are as yet unsolved, or I guess in some cases unresolved, cases of sexual assault. Potentially these are new leads that could lead to new prosecutions. Is that right?
Exactly. So there's already been three cases of the DNA test leading to new criminal charges. There are cases pending in Opaca County, Winnebago County, and Rock County as a result of this effort. And now we just have hundreds of more matches for investigators across the state to look at.
Other places, other cities and states had been working on this issue too. Had we seen this sort of thing happen there, where going back, resolving this backlog, testing these kits was reopening previously cold cases?
Exactly. And also the testing can sometimes reveal things about old cases in new ways. So in other cities, re-examining old rape kits linked together cases, so you were much more easily be able to present in court a pattern of a serial rapist or something along those lines. It could help identify suspects who hadn't previously been identified. So those types of cases in other states and cities is what pushed Wisconsin to finally start addressing the same issue here back in 2014 and 2015.
Talking to Keegan Kyle, investigative reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin, looking at new information about Wisconsin's backlog, now largely resolved, of untested sexual assault kits, leading to new information for previously cold cases. Keegan, why did it take so long to get to these, especially knowing that these might lead to the resolution of open cases?
Well, we published an investigation earlier this year that looked at the array of issues that led to the slow process of just even counting how many rape kits were out there. require the state to go out and ask for information from hundreds of police agencies scattered across the state, many of whom only had a small staffs or were paper records about rape kits. So it required a tremendous amount of work to even get a scale of how many rape kits were out there. Then it was a process of sending all of this information to state crime labs and funding that through private grants, or not private grants, but federal grants. It became a very complicated process because of both the scale of the backlog and also how many resources were dedicated to it. So it ended up taking, in some cases, 3 years for evidence from the point of discovery to the point of it coming out of labs with DNA results. And that, like you said in the intro, that became a major theme in this year's Attorney General election, of how quickly the rape kits were addressed.
Are we, as a state, actually caught up now?
There are still a very few number of old rape kits being tested. There are 7 kits that are still being tested in labs, according to the state's new numbers. There are also hundreds of kits that still could be tested if victims were to step forward and request testing. So there are lots of cases where kits were collected in hospitals, but the state felt uncomfortable testing that evidence because the kit was not associated with a reported crime, and they felt it was unjustified to have that kit tested in a crime lab without a victim's consent.
Is there a procedure if there's someone listening who says, I had one of those test kits, no charges were ever filed, no crime was reported, is there a way for them to say, yes, please do test that?
Yes, there are advocates that they can certainly reach out to. There's also a state office of victim services that they can reach out to and get involved in their case to either request information about the status of their kit. They can also work with that office to advocate for testing or charges if they want to seek charges.
Let's take things up to today now. Are there procedures in place so that we don't end up with another backlog? Have we streamlined the process so that as a new unfortunate incident happens, that these kits get tested sooner?
Yes, there have been some steps with state guidelines for how kits are handled. So police agencies are receiving a lot more information than they used to about the value of having these kits tested, about when they should send kits to state labs. The main thing that has not changed, even since 2014, are state resources, like state-funded resources to help the testing, and that's becoming an issue in state crime labs, as well as the state law around what kits should be tested has not changed. And there's still confusion over what state law requires that led to some kits not being tested. And there have been calls for changes to state law running both on Democrats and Republicans are interested in changing state law.
So that's something that could get resolved theoretically in the next session of the legislature?
Exactly.
Now, you mentioned 3 prosecutions in 3 different counties related to these DNA matches. You mentioned 200 and some cold hits in particular. Are you expecting to see now, as prosecutors and police departments review this information, another wave of prosecutions based on that information?
Possibly, but some of these cases can, even with this new evidence, it can take months to kind of reopen and reexamine these cases. So it's not necessarily going to happen quickly. It's not like we're going to see a new wave of prosecutions next week or even necessarily this year, because these cases, even after you get new evidence, can still take a while to develop.
We'll leave it there for now. Keegan, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks so much.
That's Keegan Kyle, investigative reporter for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, with us to talk about his reporting on DNA matches found in a backlog of recently tested sexual assault kits. Coming up, we'll find out about a Milwaukee elementary school's walking bus that's helping improve attendance and make the school experience more welcoming. That's coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Milwaukee elementary school is giving students in its neighborhood a safe way to get to class in the morning, a walking bus. We'll find out about the idea and what it's doing for attendance. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Steve Gotcher.
This week marks the 131st birthday of Georgia O'Keeffe, one of the most, if not the most, famous artist from Wisconsin. At first, her celebrity was embraced by her hometown of Sun Prairie, but eventually things got complicated. Dean Robbins picks up the story.
Relations between Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, and its most famous native hit a low point in the 1970s. Georgia O'Keeffe was born on a Sun Prairie farm in 1887. She left Wisconsin at age 15, studied art, and established herself as one of the world's greatest painters in the 1920s. She made a reputation with boldly original images of flowers and desert landscapes. When you look at one of her large-scale lilies, you feel an intimate bond with the curves and folds of the abstract petals. By the 1970s, O'Keeffe was legendary as an artist who pursued her own vision and a woman who lived on her own terms. Unfortunately, Sun Prairie didn't count on her independent spirit when it decided to boost its image as her hometown. After naming a park after her, city representatives asked Georgia to appear in the Sun Prairie Bicentennial Parade. They also asked her to donate a painting to the Sun Prairie Historical Museum. It's not surprising that O'Keeffe turned down both requests. She was in her 80s, so getting to Sun Prairie from her remote home in Abiquiu, New Mexico, would have been difficult. She was also going blind and not keen on letting people know it. As for donating a priceless painting, well, that's an iffy thing to ask any artist of her stature. But Sun Prairie took the refusal as an insult and, in 1977, renamed the park. It's a shame things got to that point because O'Keeffe was always proud of her roots. Wisconsin is the place that forged her strong will and prepared her to break through barriers in a male-dominated field. Georgia grew up amid women who stood shoulder to shoulder with men, making their way on the rugged frontier. With a determination typical of her clan, she envisioned an artistic career at age 10. She wowed her art teachers in Sun Prairie and at Madison's Sacred Heart Academy. By the time she and her family moved to the East Coast, she developed the fiercely unconventional personality that would make its mark on the world. This is a woman who never dressed, behaved, or painted according to any fashion. When O'Keeffe settled in a wild part of New Mexico in 1949, she had to deal with rattlesnakes and flash floods. There were no telephones, no grocery stores, no medical services. Her New York City friends wondered how on earth she survived in such harsh conditions. O'Keeffe proudly pointed to her origins in Wisconsin, a place where people worked with their hands. Thankfully, Sun Prairie has made its peace with O'Keeffe since she died in 1986. The city now honors her with a historical marker, exhibits, and special events. As a Wisconsin resident, I'm relieved that this family feud has ended. It's only right that Sun Prairie is now as proud of Georgia O'Keeffe as Georgia O'Keeffe was of Sun Prairie.
Dean Robbins is a journalist and author based in Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Steve Gotcher.
Now, a lot of us probably took a bus to school growing up. More likely than not, that bus had wheels. But at Milwaukee's Lincoln Avenue Elementary School, staff and students are creating a walking bus. The bus runs on Mondays and Fridays. It was created to raise attendance levels by giving nearby students a safe, reliable way to get to class. Regina Stieber is the community school coordinator for 16th Street Community Health Centers and Lincoln Avenue Elementary. She leads that route on Mondays. Regina, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, thank you for having us.
And Misty Ellen Kreider is school support teacher at Lincoln Avenue Elementary. She's the bus leader on Fridays. Misty Ellen, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Well, Regina, talk through the concept. Now, I didn't have walking buses as a kid. As a parent, my kids have had kind of an informal walking bus. But talk about what need you were trying to meet here by getting this group of students and staff together to walk to school.
Yeah, so Lincoln Avenue, that area of Milwaukee, parents don't really feel safe having their kids walk by themselves just because of some crime in the area. And just, you know, it's dark in the mornings when it's winter and things like that. So parents had self-identified that problem. And so we found out that this was a great way to meet that need. And basically, we walk from the school and we pick up kids that have signed up to be on the route, and we all have this really cute cutout of a walking of a school bus. It's got little windows in it, and little kids can hold on to the handles and peek their heads out the window, and then we walk to school together.
And Misty, as I understand it, this was Misty Ellen, this was an issue for attendance. These concerns were, in some cases, keeping kids from coming to school as often as they otherwise might.
That's right. Our absentee rate last year for our students was about 12%. And we found that a lot of our students weren't coming to school. Safety was an issue, but also there are other educational barriers that prevent our kiddos from coming. Very often our parents work third shift, and it's tough for them to get home and get the kids and then get them to school on time. Also, several of our parents have little ones at home, and those little ones are at risk during the winter if they have to be brought out into the elements to get the school-aged children to school. So we were trying to be creative and find an alternative for those families that were struggling to make sure that their kids could get to school, because our students are more successful if they are in school every day, and our research that we've done around attendance has shown that students that attend regularly have a higher success rate in high school and also have a higher success rate of having jobs in the future, and we wanted that for all of our students at Lincoln Avenue.
And Regina, safe neighborhood or not, school can just plain sometimes be scary for a young kid. Is there kind of a social element here to just provide that happier start to a day for some of these kids?
Yes, absolutely. We had a student on the route that last year, he was very detached from the school community. He had a really low attendance rate. And now that he's been on the bus, we have seen significant improvements in his behavior. He's smiling a lot more. He loves when we pick him up in the morning. He's super smiley. So it's a really like social group for these kids. Like once we get to school, when it's colder out, we drink hot cocoa. That was something that the previous community school coordinator had started, and it was a fun way for students to bond and really connect over all living close. And a lot of them now say hi to each other in the hallways and have formed a little friend group. So,
yeah, Misty Ellen, can you talk a little more about their reactions?
Sure. Actually, I would like to talk a little bit more about the young man that Regina was starting to tell a story about. Last year, but when he was detached, his attendance rate at school was about 50%. And since joining the school bus, that has raised up to 80%.
Wow.
So it's been a significant difference for him. Also, the little ones, they wait with their backpacks by the door.
Mm-hmm.
They're so excited. And the community has been very open to us as well. When we walk down the street, the neighborhood that's starting to wake up and go to work, oh man, I wish we had a bus like that when I was going to school. And we get honks from area neighbors and lots of waves. So it's not just exciting for the kids. The whole community surrounding the school building is very welcoming to us in the morning.
And Regina, Misty Ellen had mentioned that jump in attendance for that one student you've been talking about. Are you seeing overall this driving better attendance? Are kids showing up more since you've started this?
Yeah, for the kids that are on that route, all of their attendance has improved significantly. And so that's why we expanded it to 2 days. We just started that about 3 weeks ago. It used to be only Fridays. We're approaching our 1 year anniversary of having the walking school bus. So it's really cool to see that we have expanded. Now we're doing 2 days. So hopefully we can see even more of an impact on attendance. And we are also working on adding another route that will run simultaneously so we can pick up more kids.
And Misty Ellen, is this leading to better attendance, you know, even on days when you don't have the bus, on the Tuesday to Thursday?
Traditionally, our attendance has been low on Mondays and Fridays, and kids tend to do better Tuesday through Thursday. But for students that have traditional high absentee times, getting that kickstart on Monday mornings has helped them remain through the week and keeping them there through Friday. So the kiddos that have the hardest time with attendance, it has been improving that, yes.
Regina, it might sound like a small thing. This is just a handful of blocks in radius. Little things like this can make a surprising difference, it sounds like.
Yeah, the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, they did an article on us, and that article went viral. The Washington Post shared it, AP News, US News, and now we get to share our little story on WPR, which is really amazing for our community and for the parents and families who helped initiate this and who volunteer to walk, and for all of our teachers that volunteer their mornings because they just love their kids. And So it's been really awesome to see the impact it's had on the community. And also, we've been working with the Boys and Girls Club because now they want to implement walking school buses as their transportation initiative to help after school. And so I got to speak with some people from Boys and Girls Club, and we're starting it because our school has a Boys and Girls Club. Now they're trying to establish a route for after school. So it's really, you can see the ripples, you know, happening through the community.
Even more so, I think it's putting Lincoln Avenue on the map in our community, in the Lincoln Village. There are lots of community leaders that also see safety as a high priority in that neighborhood, and knowing that the teachers are invested in providing those types of services for students has made our connection to community agencies in the area more vibrant. We're starting to see them come more to governance councils. They are talking about our school and letting people in the area know that it's a safe place for their students to come every day.
And Regina, I imagine people reading these stories around the country or hearing us talking right now, for that matter, somewhere out there, there's a teacher or administrator or community member thinking, hey, why don't we do that? What would be your advice to them be to get it started?
I would say, you know, just start, and maybe you won't have a lot of buy-in in the beginning, or maybe it'll be hard to get some kids up on time if they're not used to coming on time every day, or maybe some people don't want to get up that early to walk. But once you start, really, like, you get to see what a joy it is to pick up these kids and just to be outside and, like, to be there in the morning when the sun's rising and everyone's happy and walking to school. Like, you really come to love that experience. So just, like, giving it a chance and having an open mind, and knowing that if you just keep pushing and persevering, that it will work.
And inviting parents personally is huge.
Yes.
Letting the parents know that we're there, making that connection. Hey, I know Johnny's having a rough time getting to school. What if we gave you this option? Would that help you in the morning? And I think that's how we started building our bus.
Yeah. And you'd be surprised what the reactions are. Like, we just added a kid to the route, and their parent was telling us, wow, God bless you. Thank you so much. This is such a blessing for you to be able to pick them up twice out of the week because of certain health issues and things like that. So,
well, that's a great place to leave it. Thanks to our guests, Regina Stieber and Misty Ellen Kreider. They're with the Lincoln Avenue Elementary School, and the walking bus program is what we've been talking about. Coming up, some of the best travel moments are the unplanned ones. We'll find out why. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 6:30 on The Morning Show, voters approved advisory referenda around the state aimed at closing the so-called dark store loophole. A state business group representative joins the show for a reaction. That's tomorrow at 6:30 on The Morning Show. Now, planning a trip or a vacation can be a lot of work. You might feel like you need to look at all the guidebooks, spend hours digging through reviews on TripAdvisor and other sites. Then you want to plan what you're going to do each day because you want to make the most of your trip and see all that there is to see. Kind of makes sense. But our next guest says we might have a better time if we leave more room for spontaneity and curiosity. The small town just outside the big city might have some undiscovered thrills. The pizza place you pass by on your way to the number two best pizza in Italy is packed with the locals. Maybe it's better. Seth Kugel is a freelance journalist, travel writer, and former writer of the New York Times column Frugal Traveler. He has two YouTube channels, Amigo Gringo and Globally Curious. He's the author of the new book, Rediscovering Travel, A Guide for the Globally Curious. Seth, welcome to Central Time. Not hearing Seth. Seth, are you there? I think we've lost the connection with Seth. Well, while we try to...
Oh, hello.
Oh,
can
Seth,
you hear me
we
now?
Gotcha. We sure can, Seth.
Okay.
Hi. Wonderful.
You know, I just had this mute button on. I don't know why you couldn't hear me, but I've turned it off.
That'll do it, and that's okay. So, Seth, I think you heard the intro there then.
Yeah.
What led you to want to write this book and kind of make us rethink, or as you say, rediscover travel?
Well, I did this travel column for about 5 or 6 years, and after about a year, I stopped paying so much attention to the places I was seeing and started paying more attention to the people who were traveling around me. And I sort of got the idea that people, you know, people only travel about, you know, 1 week a year, 2 weeks a year, three or four if they're lucky. And I thought that they're, you know, the people aren't thinking enough about the way they're traveling and what they love about travel. And I think when people think more about why they travel, then they'll be more convinced to be more spontaneous, to go off the beaten path, that sort of a thing. And then I sort of thought about this for 4 or 5 years and decided to put it together in a book.
I got to say, there's a civil war in my head when I travel. Part of me's right on board. Yeah, just go explore, wander around, find cool new stuff. And then there's the other half of my brain that's like, you will never be here again. You must see the important things. Check them off your checklist. How do we resolve that battle?
Yes. Well, I don't think this, I think it's pretty easy. You do some of each. I would never tell anyone not to see some of the great sights of the world just so that you can go into a hole in the wall pizza place and, you know, talk to a cool, you know, Italian widower or something like that. You just have to balance both of those things. I like to tell people to plan out your whole day, but then be ready to abandon your plans when something better comes up. If you really, really want to see the Statue of Liberty, you should go see the Statue of Liberty. However, you should also get off at Ellis Island and see the museum there, which is much more interesting. But that's a whole other story.
Yeah, talk about some of the things that you've encountered. You share a lot of these in your book, but that you've encountered when you do step off the itinerary.
Sure. Well, one of the things I love to do is just to sort of find a neighborhood to walk around and sort of maybe have an end point for my walk. So I was at this Argentine rodeo event and I met a tango instructor, because what else are you going to do at an Argentine rodeo event besides meet a tango instructor? So I really got along well with him. So he did two things for me. He set me up on a blind date, which is I'm not even going to talk about, but he also told me about a neighborhood. I asked him, actually. I said, what neighborhood in Buenos Aires should I just walk around? I don't want to see any tourists. I just want to see a normal neighborhood. So he gave me a neighborhood. He gave me a restaurant I should eat in there. So then that morning I mapped out where I was, where the neighborhood was. It was maybe a mile away. And I just decided that by, you know, late lunchtime, I would be at that restaurant and just sort of see what happens. And I ended up, in this case, just talking to a really interesting couple, young couple who ran a pasta store. And of course, there's all these Italian immigrants in Argentina. So that's one thing. Other things that are sort of more exciting are like when I was driving, this story is in the book, when I was driving from one Turkish city to the next in the middle of pistachio country. And I just love pistachios, pistachio ice cream, baklava. It's full of pistachios. And I realized I was driving through pistachio orchards. And I was like, huh, I've never been in a pistachio orchard. Let me sort of turn off at the next road and sort of drive through. And I got off the next road, and there was a sign to three villages. And I said, well, let's just see what these villages are. I mean, you have to know a little bit about the place you're going to. Turkey is a very friendly, welcoming place, very hospitable. So I went, and the first village, there was no one in it. The second village, some guy gave me a nasty look. And the third village I got to, and within 5 minutes, I was invited by a pistachio farmer to his house and ended up with a meal and a tour of the pistachio orchard. And, you know, that's the sort of thing you remember. I love to ask people to think back to their last trip and what images come to their head. What moments come to mind? Hopefully the good moments, not the bad moments. And often you'll find it's really not like when you went to see the Mona Lisa in the Louvre. It's often a person you met or a wrong turn you took that turned into something interesting. You know, if you think back on your trip well, let's just stick with Paris, and all you see is the Eiffel Tower, well, maybe you should be a little bit more spontaneous. But I think most people think back to people they met and experiences they had, not sort of sights that they saw.
Talking to Seth Kugel, his new book is Rediscovering Travel, A Guide for the Globally Curious. One bit of advice I love, you clearly like talking to people, meeting people when you're traveling, and you have advice, it comes down to basically, yeah, the dude standing outside the Eiffel Tower, he's not going to want to talk to tourists. You have to go to maybe places that tourists don't go to as much.
Yeah, this is sort of one of my cardinal rules. All of these rules, by the way, I had no idea what they were, and I just sort of experimented while I was doing the column, and I just sort of, at a certain point, if you do something enough and it always works, then you just make it into a rule. And so one of my real cardinal rules is that, you know, how friendly and welcoming people are to tourists is inversely related to how many tourists are there. So, like, and it just universally works. You go to a place that is not crowded with throngs of tourists, and people are more curious about you. If you go to a place where there are no tourists, then people are really curious about you. But if you go to, you know, Venice, the center of Venice, mm-hmm. every single person who's there either thinks you're a big, it's kind of like I think of as tourists in Times Square, like you're just causing problems, or you're someone who's going to spend money and I'm going to sell you something. So the business relationship between the people who live in a very touristy place and the tourists kind of kills a little bit any sort of personal relationship that you might develop.
Now, one thing that's changed a lot in my lifetime in traveling is the smartphone and all the travel apps, TripAdvisor, Abigi, there are others. How can we go wrong, I guess, if we rely too much on looking at the reviews by those who have traveled before us?
Yeah. Well, I mean, also, it's not just your lifetime unless you're a fourth grader. I mean, this has all changed in like the last decade, and it keeps changing. So I don't dislike TripAdvisor. I don't dislike the idea that there is a site and an app with endless information on tons and tons of stuff you can do. I'm just concerned about the way people use it and the way people depend on it and the way people study it to basically know everything that's going to happen before it happens. I compare it to, like, you're going to go see a movie. Do you want to read every single review written about the movie before you go? No, you want something to be a little bit of a surprise. And there's a couple reasons for that. First of all, because surprises are so great. It's the best part of travel. Discoveries. You didn't know something was there, then it was there. You'd never heard of a certain dish, and the waiter recommended it, and you tasted it. And maybe you hated it, maybe you loved it. But if you read all the reviews, there's going to be no surprises. And the second reason is because often, of course, the reviews are wrong, and often they're too good. And if you go to a place that's pretty good, but you've read reviews that say it's awesome, well, you're going to be pretty disappointed that it's pretty good. But if you just sort of stumbled into it and asked around, look what's on other people's tables around you, then a pretty good restaurant turns into a pretty good experience.
We asked people on Facebook to share their travel experiences that worked because they didn't overplan. We got a lot of responses. Let's hear from Kathleen. She says, while traveling from Boston to Maine, we stopped in Salem for a night and went on a haunted tour. It's actually very historical and informative. One of the best things I remember from that trip, never overplan your trips. I have more fun memories from random stuff we did as a family. And I can think of a lot of experiences like that myself. The random thing you did is the memorable thing. Seth, that's right on target with what you're talking about. Did we lose Seth? Are you there?
Hello?
Hey, Seth, we got you back.
I'm back. Oh, I don't know what happened. Anyway, yeah, it's the perfect balance, I think, that story of planning versus not planning. Because they did go on an organized tour, went on the ghost tour of Salem, which I'm from Massachusetts, so I've certainly been on a tour like that. And it's not like you want to just not go on any organized tours at all. But it was a spontaneous stop. Hey, we're going to stop in Salem. Whoa, Salem, isn't that where the witch trials were? Okay, let's get off and sort of see what happens. And they end up having a great time. And really, I wasn't there, so I don't know exactly what happened. But you go to a place that you haven't read that much about before, and everything is more interesting. Everything is fresher. Everything is more surprising. Of course, you're going to read up a little bit about the places you're going to go to most of the time. But really, when I keep thinking I'm going to be wrong when I'm traveling, and I say, I'm just going to get off the highway at this exit because there's a town with a funny name and I want to see what it's like. And I'm like, it's going to be a waste of my time. It's worked before, but it can't keep working. It always works. It just always does, because the world is incredibly interesting. And when things are surprising, it becomes even more interesting. I've been to such a large number of towns. I like going to towns that there are no reviews about the town on TripAdvisor at all. And the book actually starts in this town. I'm not going to give it all away. But it turns out I go to a town and there's literally nothing on TripAdvisor about it. I get to the train station and there's a map of the city with like 48 tourist attractions posted on it. So, you know, that was fun. I'm not going to say these tourist attractions were, you know, absolutely fantastic. One of my memories there is that I got this soup that kind of looked like it has – the noodles were shaped like maggots.
Nice.
So, you know, that wasn't the greatest moment. It was actually pretty tasty. I just didn't really like how they looked.
We're talking to Seth Kugel, travel writer. His new book is called Rediscovering Travel, A Guide for the Globally Curious. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever had a great travel experience that worked because you didn't overplan your trip? Or flip side, do you feel like maybe you did overplan the trip, tried to pack too much of the required sites in, didn't leave enough time for fun? And how do you use technology when you travel? Why do you travel? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post and find out what other people have to say on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with travel writer Seth Kugel. His new book is Rediscovering Travel, A Guide for the Globally Curious. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Our main question, have you enjoyed a trip more in the past when you didn't plan it, took some time off to be spontaneous on that trip, or do you have questions about how to do that? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. To your calls now, Keith is with us in Green Bay. Keith, hello.
Hi. Seth, I love your philosophy, and I've had experiences at both ends of the spectrum. I'm in my 60s. I started traveling when I retired. Last spring, I went on a tour. I went to China. It was 42 people on a bus with a Wrangler. And it was like, be here for 2 hours, be there for 2 hours, be back to the bus to this time because we have to be somewhere else. And I did a tour in Europe where it was it felt like a drive-by. You know, here's this museum, here's this park, here's this war memorial. A couple of years ago, I went to Ireland on a bike tour. That was the first 9 days of a month in the UK. And then I went to, took the train across to London, where I stayed in a 10-bed dorm room in a hostel.
There we go. And, now we're talking.
Yep. Got into some of the best conversations one night, and the World Cup rugby championships were happening in London during that period. So the hostel was full of all kinds of interesting people from all over the world. I got into an interesting conversation. One night I stopped into a sports bar for fish and chips and asked for the malt vinegar from the people at the next table. They turned out to be musicians with the Royal Philharmonic. I was on a train platform and noticed a man looking at his theater program from the same play that I'd been to. Turned out he had been a member of the Doily Cart theater for years. Got into a wonderful conversation on a train.
Keith, a lot of great stories to share. Thank you so much for calling in. He is on your page, Seth.
Well, I mean, Keith had some great stories there, but a lot of that had to do with him actually finding an excuse for talking to the people around him and leading to great stories. If you just sit there silently, probably nothing's going to happen. But you ask the guy about the program he has, you ask for the malt vinegar. I mean, that's the sort of thing where I'd hide the malt vinegar on my own table so that I could ask the next table for malt vinegar. I do stuff like that all the time. I ask for directions when I already know how to get there because I see someone I want to start a conversation with. And interesting point, though, about China. China is a very challenging place to visit. There's a lot of places there where nobody speaks English and no signs are even in Roman letters. So it is a very intimidating place to travel in a way. But when you are on a trip like that, I always tell people to just try to escape for a few hours or just take a walk around. I remember being in Shanghai and just walking into a neighborhood where there weren't any tourists and just having odd interactions with people and trying to buy. One experience I always remember, I was trying to buy gloves. And I asked, how much are these gloves? It was winter. And the guy holds up his hand as if it were like a gun and with his fingers. And that symbolizes like seven in Chinese. And I'll always remember like what a lack of communication when we have a different way of counting on our hands than another culture does. It's just something that totally struck me and it wouldn't have happened on a tour.
Keith, thanks for calling in. We'll go now to Mika in Stevens Point. Mika, hi.
Hi. First of all, the show is great, but I was thinking about the time a couple of years ago I was in Japan teaching. And I was with a whole bunch of people, and we were there for 3 months. And I had a bunch of sites planned because we had a week off to do kind of whatever we wanted. And so there was a bunch of cities that I wanted to visit, and I kind of had, like, the itinerary set up. And then everybody decided to back out.
Oh, no.
So I was like, okay, and I never have gone traveling by myself. So I decided, you know what, I all have my train pass. It covers the bullet trains. I'm going to do everything by myself. I don't actually care. And I was like, you know what? And I was so mad at the point. I just kind of threw away my travel guide. And I was like, I'm just gonna go to these cities and I'm just gonna see what's up. So I went to the city. I just threw away all my itinerary and I went to the three cities, Kyoto and Nagoya and Osaka. And one of them is the food capital of the world. I believe it's Osaka. And I was like, you know what? I'm just gonna find some of these tiny little hole in the wall shops. It was some of the best food I've ever had. I found these really cool, like, little stores and stuff. And I was like, you know, if I stuck to my itinerary, I would have never been able to experience any of these things. And I was so upset that I had, and I saw some of the best sites ever, and I was so upset that I was counting on everybody to come with me. And I almost ruined it for myself by just being like, you know what? I'll just stay in the hostel for the next week. I don't actually care.
Oh, Mika, so thank great. You so much. Yeah, she showed them by having an awesome time. Take that, so-called friends.
Right.
Revenge doesn't have to be part of it, but yeah, talk about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is a little nerve-wracking to travel on your own, especially for the first time. Sometimes, you know, there's also gender differences, you know, feel different, you know, men sometimes have different safety issues than women. But it's so great to hear about a story where someone just goes off and just finds stuff. I was thinking when she was talking about the little hole in the wall, I guarantee that hole in the wall has 100 reviews on TripAdvisor. But I guarantee it tasted better because she didn't know about those reviews.
Mika. Thank you so much for sharing that story. And something I want to get to, Seth, you're not just talking about having this attitude when you're traveling in faraway lands. You do this in the United States, probably, I'm guessing, in your own neighborhood.
Well, absolutely. I happen to live in Queens, New York. Actually, we're going to get the Amazon headquarters too, so I don't know how that's going to affect the tourist attractions there. But my neighborhood is full of crazy restaurants, incredibly diverse. And I love walking around it. I try to walk home from the subway a different route every day, so I can sort of bump into something I never knew about. But you can definitely do this in your local city. You can do it the next state over. These work everywhere. You don't have to be in China or Japan.
And I don't know, sometimes as Americans, I think, yeah, we want to talk to strangers, and sometimes we want to just close up and not have that conversation with the person we ask directions of, or the you know, wait staff at the restaurant, whatever. Give us some little social advice where we're traveling in the United States to make these connections.
Well, I think, you know, it's funny, people from abroad often tell me that when they come to the United States, they're really surprised at how friendly everybody is. Like, I don't know how we got a reputation of not being friendly, but they're surprised that people are so helpful to them and all that kind of stuff. I would just say that when you are running around, obviously some days you're not going to want to talk to anyone. I get it. That's fine. But you do want to be a little conscious of the local culture, even the local sort of regional culture. You know, what people talk about in different places is different. And you just have to always be sort of traveling with the – I always tell people, realize or at least think about that you're kind of an idiot when you go somewhere else. Like, you don't know anything about how people are acting. You don't know anything about how the local culture sort of works. So just realize that anything you do might be a big mistake. And observe the people. And this totally goes for the United States. I mean, what a diverse, incredible country to travel in. I once took a drive. I'd realize, you know, in New York, we're always talking about the coast, and actually I love Wisconsin and Chicago and the Midwest and stuff, but sort of that middle of the country from like Louisiana up to North Dakota, I had never really been in. So I'm like, I'm just going to take a road trip. And boy, you know, people were just so almost painfully friendly. Huh. And I mean that in a totally good way.
And that's all the time we have. Thanks to Seth Kugel. His new book is called Rediscovering Travel, A Guide for the Globally Curious. Hope we can talk to Seth about travel again in the future. You can keep sharing your stories and read other people's stories over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tomorrow on Central Time, CNN is suing the Trump administration after a reporter was banned from the White House press pool. We'll talk about the tough relations between presidents and the press. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time.